Blog Talk Radio.
Hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk and beyond. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan Podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners, in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And we always like to dive into the legacy of the both the Dodgers and the Giants, the National League New York legacy. And so without further ado, let me welcome on somebody I like to call the Mets fan incarnate himself, and that is Faith and Fear in Flushing's Greg Prince. Greg, always a pleasure. It's been a couple years now since we've done a legacy podcast.
And we're still here, Sam, both us and the Mets.
Exactly. And, you know, they've had a rough time of it lately. And of course, you know, sometimes when they're playing this way, I do think back to the Daffiness Boys. You know, I think of that term and the echoes of the Dodgers and the Giants. And I know that you have personally adopted as your grandfather team the New York Baseball Giants. And you know, when the Mets are going through a stretch like that, do you ever think back to just that overall legacy of wait till next year in many ways?
Well, hopefully it's too soon for next year. This year just got here, or so it seems, although we are, after this weekend, one quarter of the way through this year. But it's, you know, the Giants and the Dodgers provide a good reminder that, you know, it's a long road in any given year, in any given era. You know, I can think of one Giant team in particular that was pretty well buried behind the Dodgers this time of year and even far later. And that certainly didn't write the entire outcome by May. So, teams have stretches. These Mets got off to a 9-4 start. Things look pretty promising. And since then, they have lost 18 of 24. I think today was the first day where I woke up really in sort of a crotchety mood about them, for lack of a better word. So that's pretty good that you can get 37 games into a season and not be disgusted with your team. Up until now, I sort of looked at it, you know, I took like the 9-4 start as sort of, you know, the direction in which they were going, and, you know, most of the losses since then have been, well, you know, that's just the way it goes. It's still early. You know, sometimes you're going to get out pitched, sometimes you're going to get out hit. And finally, after a 1-5 road trip through Milwaukee and San Diego, I'm like, all right, enough of the default optimism. Some things here got to change, but it's a long season. It was a long season, you know, in Brooklyn and in Upper Manhattan for many years. So, to quote probably every manager, take them one at a time.
Take them one at a time. That's all you can do. Sometimes you got to take it one base at a time. Sometimes you got to take it one strike at a time, one pitch at a time. And I don't know whether the numbers were as sharp for the Dodgers and the Giants at any point in their history as to what we're about to refer to. But something that is remarkable, and I was reading about it yesterday from one of your posts from back in 2012. When things were starting to fall apart for that team, and you were basically reminded in the 2012 season of the 1962 team, and how they had this knack for being just on the brink of getting that tying run in or getting that winning run in, but not being able to. And the numbers for a 120 loss team, 56 times. Did they get the tying run or winning run close but no cigar? And that's a remarkable number for the worst team in modern era to have.
Yeah, you know, but that speaks to something about that team. You know, they were never quite out of it. You know, not every game was a 17-4 loss, which, by the way, was an actual score between the Giants and Mets at least one game, or even the Dodgers or Mets or Giants and Mets in 1962. There were some blowouts, to be sure. You don't get to lose 120 games with every game being close. But, you know, when you're a fan, you know, and you have that many losses, you know, I guess you can sit back and try to discern, you know, what is more, for lack of a better word, painful, you know, to constantly be, you know, having those 17-4, 10-0 types of games, or, oh my God, we only lost 3-2 or 2-1 or 4-3. And, oh, we had the winning run on third base, and if only, and, you know, fill in the blank, if only Thronberry hadn't struck out, or you know, if only Todd Frazier hadn't struck out, or, you know, insert your choice of Giant or Dodger of your for frustration. I think it's I think you wind up with a rich tapestry of losses in the course of a season. You know what, though? Thinking back, you know, to the greatest season I ever lived through, which was 1986, greatest season any Mets fan ever lived through in terms of record, they lost 54 games. I remember they were horribly frustrating. We left the winning run on third base type of games then. So you're never fully satisfied if you're a fan. You know, you can be reasonable and you can be logical and you can say, oh, well, it just wasn't our day. So many times, once in a while, you're just going to throw your hands up and throw the remote at the television or do whatever it is you do to express your dismay. But then you're back the next day, and on a day like this, when your team isn't playing, despite the previous six games not being that much fun, despite the fact that you didn't get nearly enough sleep because the Mets were in San Diego, you know, just despite losing an 18-inning game in Milwaukee the other night, all of that stuff, you're disappointed that there isn't another game. So, you know, as within the context of what we're talking about here, the Mets being the National League legacy keepers for that which was established in New York all those years ago, you won a game the next day. You know, the rough part was, you know, the years where there was no game the next day from 58 to 61. So, you know, a day like this we'll lick our figurative wounds, try to use the time we have wisely, and you know, be back at them tomorrow night at 7:10.
Yeah, and sometimes it seems that as much as you want the game today, that it kind of gives not only the team a breather, but the fans a breather too, especially as we raise hell on Twitter in this such hyper sensitive time that we're currently living in. And, you know, I think that, you know, everybody likes to say, like, oh, well, now you gotta lick your wounds and beat up on the Marlins, but it never seems like it's all that easy with a team like the Marlins, no matter how much worse they are. You know, I think that people, you know, before the season, my friend who's a Phillies fan was like, just be happy you play them 19 times. I'm like, it's never that easy with this team. You can't just say that. But going to what you were talking about with 1951 and the Giants, you know, they were like 13, 14 games behind in August. But back in the day, you played these same teams so often. I mean, you have examples of the 2015-2016 Mets, and I always like to think of the 2005 Astros when I think that people are talking about how buried the Mets are at this point, or could be at this point. I think about the fact that the 2005 Astros were 15-30 and made the World Series. Do you think that compared to 1951 with that schedule and how it is now, do you think it's harder to be able to go on stretches like that because you're not facing these same teams so often?
Well, I think the one thing we have to keep in mind about an accomplishment like the 2005 Astros, or to a lesser extent, the 2016 Mets, who were 60-62 in August. There's a wild card. In fact, there's two wild cards now, 1-05. What the 51 Giants faced, what the 69 Mets faced, were daunting distances, and one shot. You had to catch the team that was in first place, or you just had to forget about it. It helped to have 22 games a year versus the team that you were chasing. But you know what? They had 22 games against you, and you needed help along the way, and to the point that the Mets are playing the lousy Miami Marlins this weekend, you sort of have to count on the Marlins of the world in a given season to rise up and beat the other team along the way. Certainly, both in the case of the 51 Dodgers and the 69 Cubs, those teams had to lose some games when they weren't playing, the team that eventually caught them. A lot has to go right. It's a little funny to think about it. We're 4.5 games out with 125 to play, I think. So, we're not there yet. But, there is sort of a last refuge of a scoundrel quality to saying, thank goodness we get to play the Marlins now, and we get the Nationals when they're not at full strength, and we get the Tigers because, as far as we know, they're not any good. But, I think anybody who's ever watched a baseball season unfold, every team is dangerous. I don't even have to go back to 51. Don't even have to go back to 1964, but I will. The year that the Phillies and Reds and Cardinals were coming down to the wire, and the Phillies were in the process of blowing a 6.5 game lead with 10 to go, and the Cardinals appeared to be in the driver's seat, and they were playing the 100-plus loss Mets. Mets beat them on a Friday night, a Saturday, and nearly helped facilitate a three-way tie on the last day of the season. These were the Mets who were on their way to a 53-109 record, which was their best ever to that point, 3 years in. So, I suppose you would want to take dead aim. I'm trying to think of a really good example, and I guess in 1980, to invoke the Dodgers here, they were three games behind the Astros with three to play. And they had three with the Astros that weekend at Dodger Stadium, and they won all three. And, hey, look at that. We're tied. Then they had a one-game playoff, which the Astros won, and that was that for the Dodgers. So, as the season gets late, sure, you want those head-to-head matchups because you want the illusion of control. Their destiny is in their own hands, which where the Mets were concerned, and maybe some years with both the Dodgers and Giants kind of makes you nervous because, I don't know that I would trust certain Mets teams with the there and therefore by quality of transference, my destiny in their hands. But, you want those games ahead of you. What I remember, you mentioned the 2005 Astros. They were 15-30, which was that record stands out to me. That was the Mets record the year they fired Joe Frazier and hired Joe Torre. And they were hopeless. And, Torre's team won 7 out of 8 and then, went back to being the Mets of that era, which lasted far too long. But I remember a Houston newspaper columnist wrote, that's it, they're dead. It's over. Forget it, folks. Wait till next year or whatever he wrote. And, they came along. Again, the wild card helped. The fact that it wasn't like there was one team out ahead of everybody else, and they eventually won however many games, probably 89, something like that, to win the wild card. And then, good luck in the playoffs took over. So, Yeah, it would be great if we were here, you know, harking back to, you know, great starts by New York National League teams, because we were inspired by a great start by this New York National League team. Unfortunately, we're not there at the moment.
It's such a pet peeve of mine when people are posting the standings at 7-3 and 9-4, and you know, this is something that, like, people seem to have you know, short-term memory loss. The 2017 team was 7-3 and in first place. Obviously, we know that the 2018 team was 11-1 at some point. And it's weird how these games that you think to yourself, oh, well, it's just one game, whether it's the game where they could have gone 12-1, but the Nationals came from behind in the seventh or eighth inning, whichever it was last year in 2018. I was mentioning how you have to put your foot on the neck of the Phillies after throwing behind Rhys Hoskins this year, but the Mets came out listless as an offense, and the Phillies took over in the next game. And I was getting into it about a fan who was just like, it's just one game. You can't give Callaway the blame here. And it's like, but these, you see that these things have ramifications, and something gets thrown off if you're not able to continue to make a statement. And the same thing just happened the other day when Pete Alonso followed up, and I think that he's just been a fantastic rookie, and every time, like, the league seems to be catching up to him right now, he seems to be catching back. And also, you know, especially without David Wright right now, I think he's taking a really almost veteran-type leadership role for this team. But it's those follow-ups where you have to continuously, you know, in this sport, it's such a quick turnaround that you have to, you know, they say it's your momentum's only as good as your next day starting pitcher. And we didn't necessarily, we had somebody making his major league debut. I'm sorry, not major league debut, but his Mets major league debut yesterday. But he was, I think, the last issue with why the team was not able to get over the hump yesterday. And, you know, it's just moments like this, and I'm wondering, you know, obviously, like, I just mentioned the 2017 team, so Mickey Callaway cannot necessarily be the reason why, you know, his track record in 2 years in a row is losing a little bit of steam, but what do you think he needs to do in his sophomore year to prevent what happened last year, which it was June completely making us think that this team was going to be another one of those Mets 100-loss teams?
That's a good question. It may be an unanswerable question in this day and age, because I don't know that the way teams are set up, meaning, you know, front offices, analytics departments, you know, all having their say over the day-to-day machinations of a baseball team, that the manager is necessarily solely responsible for, you know, getting a team, I don't know if you want to say motivated, prepared, you know, hopefully that stuff is part of it. You know, is he making the lineup? Is he having the lineup sent down to him, which seems to actually kind of be how things work today. Is it a matter of just kind of, you know, keeping guys fresh, making sure everybody is on the same page, all that communication stuff that, you know, for 6.5 years we heard Terry Collins was a master at. That's why he was, like, such an improvement over Jerry Manuel. And then after half a season of wallowing in 2017, we heard that Terry Collins was a terrible communicator. He never told anybody whether they were playing or not. I don't really get the sense from Mickey Callaway that he is a reason for their fleeting success or for their recurring failure, which I guess, you know, speaks to a certain ineffectuality. And again, this is from afar. I don't know what's going on in that clubhouse. I can only gauge, you know, what I read and hear from those who are closer to the situation. But it does feel like a season that might be slipping away. And again, all it takes is a, you know, hey, we had a great weekend against the Marlins. Bring on the Nationals. Maybe the Phillies had a bad weekend. We picked up ground. Maybe it's too soon to worry about those things. But ultimately, though, to what I was saying about front offices, did they provide him and his coaches with the material from which to avoid a season like last year? And that I'm not so sure about. Right now, the Mets seem to have constructed a roster immune to success. I get the feeling it's the fact that they sent down Dominic Smith about a week ago really speaks badly to how the Mets operate. I think that you have your best left-handed bat off the bench, and when you had to make a move to get somebody back after an injury, you said, "Well, we don't know what else to do. We wouldn't want to lose somebody like Keon Broxton. There's a 150 batting average because somebody might pluck him on waivers because we don't have options on him. Well, let's just send down the guy who helps us win games." Not to say that Dom Smith would have gotten, five big hits on this road trip and made everything better, but it just seems short-sighted, and it just seems to be how the Mets have operated all year, trying to figure out how to, hold on to a bunch of pieces to a puzzle that's not coming together as it is. When you look at guys like Todd Frazier and, you have Jed Lowrie coming back. We don't know what Jed Lowrie is going to be, but obviously he's going to get his opportunities. What does that mean for a youngster like J.D. Davis? You're still kind of plugging in Jeff McNeil wherever you can because you took away his most natural position at second by bringing in 36-year-old Robinson Cano. You're kind of squeezing him off of third base. You're insisting he's a left fielder. He's not really a left fielder. And again, if things work out well, great. He's in left field and he's hitting 350. But, balls fall in or, he doesn't quite know how to, leap at the wall and catch one, which, doesn't happen that often, but it happened in San Diego yesterday. So it just gets the feeling that the entire thing is set up to not succeed at every turn. And lo and behold, the Mets are 3 games below 500. I don't really get the sense that Callaway is a driving force to bring them out of it, but I'm not sure it's him and him alone. That's the reason that this team is not doesn't feel better positioned.
Yeah, and as they say, we'll have to see one way or the other. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. I'm going to switch gears now. Going back to somebody who is near and dear to many New York baseball fans' hearts, and that's Casey Stengel. When we were talking about the 1962 team, the 1964 team even, I believe still had Casey Stengel at the managerial helm.
Oh, yeah.
If I remember correctly, 1965 was the last year. But I looked at his playing years, and what's remarkable about it, he was obviously not a Hall of Fame caliber player, but what stands out to me was that in his age 31 and 32 seasons, mind you, at that point, based off of the plate appearances, he was relegated to bench duty. But Casey Stengel for the New York Giants hit .368 in 1922 and .339 in 1923. And overall, over a 14-year career, he hit .284. And he was a darling coming up for the Brooklyn team. He was a big fan favorite, and Casey Stengel was Casey Stengel throughout. Had that bubbling personality and Stengelese, as they like to say, going all the way back to his Brooklyn days. So he was very much thought of in very endearing terms. But I wonder, coming back to 1921, 1922, especially following a World Series appearance for the Dodgers, how much that must have been a thorn in the Dodgers fans' side, the fact that he was hitting so well for the biggest rival they had, the New York baseball Giants.
It's always tough to see your former player succeeding for your ongoing rival. Of course, it wasn't a direct route, from the Dodgers to the Giants. Casey went to Pittsburgh. then from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia before John McGraw got his man, and then he contributed to some great Giant teams. But years later, the Dodgers fans had to watch Leo DeRocher, their Leo DeRocher, lead the Giants to glory. We've seen it. In the modern era, we saw Daniel Murphy go from a beloved Met to reviled National for the 20 minutes where we fancy the Washington Nationals are blood rivals. So, this sort of thing happens. I mean, Casey Stengel, it's funny to think about Casey Stengel in his playing career, that he was basically Casey, as you said, he was Casey Stengel. He was a personality and, a bizarre character of the game in the 19-teens, 50 years before, Mets fans got to embrace him as their own and as the guy who was kind of defining their character. He was, defining the Brooklyn Robins character, and would stop off to be a memorable part of the Giants. Still that guy, Casey Stengel, still that character who would go to Boston and manage in the 30s and not manage all that well, or at least the team didn't do that well. Bringing to mind Warren Spahn, who was a Boston Brave, and many years later a New York Met, who said, I played for Casey Stengel before and after he was a genius. Because when Casey Stengel was a genius, he was wearing the Yankee uniform. And, it kind of helped, much as Mickey Callaway might admit, if you got him alone, it helps to have really good players if you want to be a really good manager. And Casey Stengel had a lot of good players between 1949 and 1960 in the Bronx. So, if you can't be good, maybe the lesson here is at least be entertaining. And nobody ever accused Casey Stengel of not being that.
That is for sure. And what's remarkable even more, like dissecting these numbers, is that, during his Brooklyn years, he was clearly a playing 124 games, averaging about that. In 1917, he played 150 games of 622 plate appearances, only batting .257 that year. He did have 73 RBIs that year, but what's so crazy about his 1922 and 1923 New York Giants seasons was that he not only batted .368 and .339 respectively with some great on-base percentages as well, but he hit 48 RBIs and 43 RBIs in only 250 at-bats and 218 at-bats respectively for those World Series winning one of them is a World Series winning team. Obviously, we know what happened in 1923 when the Yankees finally got their own home. But those are some remarkable RBI numbers. And I'm sure if I go even further, you'll see that he must have been coming up in a lot of big spots and coming through in those spots.
And was probably trusted by McGraw to come through in those big spots. And, rewarded his manager's trust. I mean, you talk about the 1923 World Series, the first one the Yankees won, defined up to a point by Casey Stengel and his inside-the-park home run exploits. He had two home runs in that World Series, lifetime World Series, and, of course, that was the only postseason there was. A .393 hitter, 1916, 22, and 23, the first one for the Dodgers. This is the kind of player who, years later, I wonder, what analytics would have said about that kind of player years later, because he sounds, and I'm sure the numbers are there to be analyzed, but, this is the kind of player that fans throughout baseball history have cottoned to, and they always want to see that kind of guy up. Look at those RBI numbers. Look at the way he ran the bases. And, you know, there was probably somebody willing to take out an abacus because there were no calculators then and say, no, he's not really that good. You know, it's overblown. You're putting reputation ahead of production. But in a way we are fortunate that everything sort of has to be figured out retroactively, because it's nice to have those legends. And I think that's where the interest of people like you and me in these teams that we never saw comes from, the fact that people, you know, kept the legend alive and kept telling the stories. And the numbers are important, but they're also sort of incidental. To fast forward back to the present day, kind of gets me down, as much as I love, say, Pete Alonso hitting really long home runs. I am, after, I guess now it's been in the baseball vocabulary for about 4 years now, the phrase exit velocity, which is fine if that's something that analytics departments want to have and in their arsenal of figuring out why they want to keep this player or that, that's great. I don't mind hearing about it. But the second that a home run is hit and I start seeing a barrage of tweets telling me that, you know, Pete Alonso hit a home run that left Petco Park at 117.2 miles per hour, whatever it was. Like, that doesn't mean a damn thing to me. Because you can say it left at 106 miles an hour, and that would still sound really good. You could also tell me that, the Todd Frazier popped out on a ball that went, you know, I don't know how 98 miles an hour, whatever. This means nothing to me. You know, if you want to tell me it hit off the Western Metal Building sign in left field of Petco Park and bounced back into the center field pavilion, that tells me all I need to know. Telling me that so and so, you know, ran the bases this many, you know, feet per second, it leaves me cold. It honestly gives me a sinus headache. And again, I'm not trying to provoke a rear guard action here against progress. I'm all for it. I'm all for using all of this stuff to get an edge to help your team win a game. I look at the shift as kind of I don't want to say necessary evil, but I see balls that go into gloves that I think are heading to the outfield. I understand it. I understand why you want to do certain things to win. It's just you lose something if you just kind of throw numbers out there without any real context to them. Now, perhaps after another several years of hearing 118.3 mile per hour exit velocity, it will be second nature, the same way saying, hey, he drove in, you know, Don Clendenin drove in 97 runs in 1970, and I'll understand immediately, hey, that's pretty good. But right now, it just feels like numbers for numbers' sake. I think to a certain degree, when we were going through kind of the push and pull of sabermetrics versus why are they bothering me with OPS, you know, circa 2005, I think part of it was just the people who were early adopters just wanted to keep throwing the numbers of these things out there. You know, look at his FIP, without really stopping to explain what that meant. And I have found, as somebody who, you know, came to baseball with the 1969 Mets when none of these numbers existed, that when somebody calmly explains to me why I should care about fielding independent pitching, to use that as an example, and I kind of take a beat and say, oh, I get it. I remember Sean Markham of the 2013 Mets, who was something like 1-9, had a remarkably good fielding independent pitching average, or percentage, whatever you would call it. And it helped me understand that, okay, he's just kind of pitching in some bad luck here. They're not making the plays behind him. I should be happy to a certain degree, or at least I shouldn't cringe when Sean Markham comes into a game. And really, that kind of got me on his side for a few months until he was released and he started criticizing Gary Cohn, Keith Hernandez, and Ron Darling for perhaps criticizing him some night. And I said, well, you know, if you don't think those guys know their baseball, then, you know, get lost. basically the way I saw it. But this stuff all has its place. And I guess the reason I've gone off on a tangent from Casey Stengel in 1922 to Sean Markham in 2013 with a stop at balls leaving 118.3 miles per hour is because I think, you know, in the long run, you know, we're going to tell the stories of guys who did, you know, who lifted their hats and pigeons flew out. you know, as we tell those kinds of Casey Stengel stories through the years, or the black cat that runs on the field. Nobody measured how fast the black cat ran in front of the Cubs dugout in September 9th, 1969. We just enjoy the imagery. And, you know, if Cool Papa Bell was so fast, he was in bed he was under the covers before the lights went out, as the story goes. That tells me a lot more than I need to know about the exit velocity or the feet per second or whatever it is that his home to first time would have covered. So, of course, you know, keep track of everything. Let's just be careful to tell it well, and not just bombard us with numbers that don't yet have any meaning other than, wow, Pete Alonso hit a ball to the left at 118 miles. He leads. That was a statistic I saw yesterday, I think, on SNY. Like, more home runs hit 112 miles per hour or faster. He leads all of baseball. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? You know, that balls that left the ballpark at 107 miles per hour are somehow less important. It's like, no, you found these statistics and you want to make it sound good. And somebody, quite frankly, is sponsoring, this stuff, because every one of these numbers always comes with a caveat that, you know, Amazon. See, I'm glad I can't remember what the hell it was called. Amazon something. Statcast. Web services, thank you. See, they've infiltrated you. They'll infiltrate me eventually. great. But, I'd rather hear about, the time Dave Kingman's ball crashed through a window on Waveland Avenue as it left Wrigley Field is more telling to me than the fact of however fast it got on its horse, shall we say, and caused property damage. And, all I can say at the end of this is, may they find more numbers and more imagery and more explanations for all the home runs Pete Alonso will hit, because right now he and Jeff McNeil are the most exciting part of Mets baseball in 2019, which I wasn't expecting, but that's the beauty of baseball, that the things you don't expect, whether it's a team coming back from 13 and a half games behind or a rookie who is still a rookie because nobody saw fit to put him on the roster last year when maybe he could have given us a sneak preview.
Exactly. And if you are listening now, you are listening to the archive, and we appreciate that. We have about 5 minutes left, but to touch on what you were saying, there's probably a lot of balls that were very important that were hit by Casey Stengel and to present-day players like Jeff McNeil that only were hit with about 85 miles per hour exit velocity, but Jeff McNeil or Casey Stengel was able to beat it out like he did the other day. Going to what you were saying about those numbers, I remember, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, when either I saw it on television or I saw it most likely in a tweet as a screen grab, was all those numbers regarding Pete Alonso and some of these new analytical power numbers. And I went down the SMY list on the page wondering when there was going to be something that I cared about in terms of Pete Alonso's numbers, and nothing there. I can't tell you. The only thing I can tell you was exit velocity, and I don't remember the number, and I just remember that the other things had something to do with exit velocity, but I could not factor that in. Exit velocity, when I'm, doing research for this project and the story that I'm trying to tell, it's not going to be – there's nothing in exit velocity that's going to tell me how important Dolph Camilli was for the Brooklyn Dodgers of the late 30s and early 40s, how important Pete Reiser was before he kept crashing into walls and getting concussions from being beamed. It's not like – we don't know how fast the ball was thrown by people who hit Pete Reiser in the head. All we know is that he suffered considerably – because of the damage from either getting hit in the head or the way he would throw himself into cement walls or the way he got run out there just to play baseball in the Army. Those are the things that tell the story that we're trying to tell. And as of now, all we do know is that Pete Alonso can hit balls rather far. But just like he said the other day, Mr. Alonso said, and going back to the leadership element that he is starting to gain traction with, the only thing that matters at the end is not that rookie of the month, it's not exit velocity, it's going to be that World Series. And that's those are the only things that matter when it comes to telling the story.
Yeah, you know, you invoked David Wright's name earlier, and I was struck the other day thinking, it's interesting to me that, you know, I did through baseball reference, I added up all the players who David Wright played with from 2004 through last year, including, when he was on the disabled list forever, and, because he still was the captain, he was still an active player, still, cross paths with those guys. And it was something like a third of every Met since 1962 played with David Wright because he was there so long. And now Pete Alonso kind of appears, literally like the next day, in baseball terms. They never played. They actually, I think, crossed paths in Las Vegas last year. They were both on the roster there briefly. But it does feel like, there is a successor. I personally was always kind of looking for a successor to David Wright in a way, because David Wright's, very admirable steadiness all those years when the Mets were not, achieving our dreams for them. I always found a little maddening. He was such a professional, and I kind of just wanted him to be, kind of raise his voice. I always thought Ike Davis would be that guy, and, that didn't work out. In a way, I thought Ahmed Rosario might be, the vanguard of a kind of a new wave, and that hasn't happened yet. And here comes Pete Alonso, who wasn't really that highly touted until last year, and he seems to be that guy. We don't know. There's a ways to go in his career. We hope there's a career to go in that career. But he does seem to be a veteran in rookie's clothing. Tremendous upside. Yeah, I have been guilty of, oh my God, he just, he reached for that pitch. The league has figured him out. Well, that was a flash in the pan. It's over. And then he hits the ball very far, however you want to measure it. So, he seems to be whatever happens this season, and we don't know, could be a middling season, could still be a great season, could be a terrible season. This is fun to keep track of. To kind of jump on this guy's back, shall we say, and see where he leads us. Because even in the so-so seasons, you need somebody like this to hang on to. And much like what David Wright was to us in 2004, or what Willie Mays was to the Giants fans in 1951, to really reach for something, or what Darryl Strawberry was in 1983. Maybe Pete Alonso is that to us in 2019, that, we don't know what the year will be, but, we're going to watch this kid, convince us or die trying, shall we say, that we're going somewhere. And this is the kid who's taking us there. It's very exciting. And, I noticed
it is.
The other night,
yeah.
when he hit that home run with however much the exit velocity was, it was his 11th home run, Edwin Diaz came in, had some trouble, but got his ninth save. And I was thinking, Pete Alonso has more saves than Edwin Diaz. And, you have to add caveats. You can't have a save. You can't have a save without a win. So Edwin Diaz only had so many chances, but Edwin Diaz has done a pretty good job. He doesn't have 57 saves yet. That would be impossible. But, we're always convinced that the new closer is going to become a Met and just kind of, evaporate, but that hasn't happened yet. So he's doing this job, and here's a guy who a year ago at this time was just sort of, in terms of Alonso, was just a guy, I think it was a double A, and there was only like some stirring of, why don't they get Pete Alonso here? And he has more home runs than your closer, who is considered, a top-notch closer for a team that has been pretty good up until now, until really this road trip where they had a winning record. He has more home runs than that guy has saves. And it struck me, and again, if you were
hey,
to
Greg,
say to me that...
Greg, I'm sorry.
Gotta go.
Greg, I'm sorry to cut you off. Yeah, sorry to cut you off, but it looks like we're about to get cut off. And so I just wanted to thank you before the air left the tires, if you will. And it's always a pleasure to talk baseball with you, you know, and as we know from many podcasts, we can keep going and going.
Thank you for allowing me my tangents.
Thanks, Rick.